Anyway, this is a dynamic group, and Monica is one of them. Please give a warm Tulare County welcome to Monica.
Thank you for making me laugh. My name is Monica, and I'm an alcoholic. Do I really sound that loud? I'm extremely grateful to be here today. I'm extremely honored. I'm going to do my best to try to be as honest with everyone as possible, because I feel that that is extremely important to my recovery. When Bill asked me to do this, I wanted to say no, but I wanted to stay sober more, so I said yes. I had the sad childhood. I had all the reasons to want to drink. I was the person who told you, you know, if you had gone through what I went through, you know, I threw the pity party, you know, like my childhood was terrible. If you had these things happen to you, if you knew what I'd been through, you would drink as much as I did. You know, so today I don't have to be a victim anymore, and I could take responsibility. And a huge part of that, I think, is acceptance of the past. And I know that just being aware of that is one thing, and then you can take action after that. You know, I don't have to be a victim today, and I can take responsibility for my recovery. For that, I am responsible. So when I first started drinking, I was probably around 15. I grew up in a home of a lot of alcoholics. I'm Hispanic, and in my background, there is a lot of heavy drinking. Every party, every first communion, every baptism, especially children's parties, apparently that's like a really big thing to drink a lot. And that was what was, you know, what I seen as a child was important for me to fit in with my own family, you know, because I, growing up, never really felt a part of, I didn't feel like a part of my family, I didn't feel a part of with friends, you know, so this was like my ticket in. It was like, when am I old enough to like start drinking, you know? And one of my first drunks, you know, my family got me drunk. We're in Mexico. They're the ones, you know, giving me what, mezcal mixed with like tea, and like, oh, like try to hide me from my mom. And you know, that night wasn't my worst drunk, but you know, I had an embarrassing moment where, you know, you're kind of out of it and you end up peeing in front of a front yard and realizing there's a family like right there. It's like, oh, you know, that's not a big deal, right? So, you know, I remember that trip to Mexico. I think I spent the entire time drunk, and I loved it. I love the effect it gave. I love that I didn't have to feel my feelings. I love that I was a part of with my family. I loved who I became. People liked me. I wasn't this shy person. I didn't keep to myself. You know, I was insecure. Like growing up as a child, I like literally hated myself. Like, I cried a lot. I remember crying a lot, and I remember my parents just being like, oh, is she going to cry again? Just send her to her room, you know? So it was like, when I found alcohol, it was like, oh, thank God. Like, I found something to make me feel better, to help me be okay. Like, not have to deal, I guess. And so when I came back from that trip, it was on for me. You know, a lot of people drink because their friends are drinking or whatever, and I was not. Like, I was drinking just to go to school. I was drinking just to feel like, I guess, the same effect of like being a part of and fitting in. And you know, my friends would be like, oh, that's just Monica, you know, she's putting vodka in a water bottle, like that's what she does. So like, fast forward to like when it really popped off for me, my first blackout, I was 18 years old, and it started a pattern for me. It was me waking up in a blackout in a tub my friends usually panic. Like, this is my pattern. Like, panic, not knowing what to do because my eyes are rolling in the back of my head. And I'm throwing up. And they're like, well, what do we do with Monica? Let's throw her in the tub. So that started off, like, my career of drinking. And into my 20s, I can remember that happening a lot. I can remember one time that I have now forgiven a friend. I remember being at a party and she thought it was a good idea to take my clothes off and put me in the bathtub. And then her boyfriend says, hey, we gotta go. So they go. And they leave me there. And I'm like, you know, in such a vulnerable state, you know. Yes, I am responsible for putting myself in that situation, but I've also felt this sense of betrayal from my friend. Sorry, guys, I'm a little bit nervous. And luckily I had somebody who came, you know, there was a random guy at that party who knew me from high school, and he guarded the door, and he protected me, and he called one of my best friends to come pick me up, you know. But it was like, that kept happening to me. That was my, like, when I put alcohol into my body, I lose control, and I wake up in random places with different people and unsafe environments, you know. And I kept doing it to myself, but it wasn't enough to make me stop. And I remember going to a party, you know, and of course my intention when I went to a party is not to get effed up, like, bad, like, this is gonna be it. I was going to Fresno State, and it was like, yes, frat parties, the best parties, it was like an amazing time, like, you know. But I wasn't going to school, so we went to a party, and you think it would be your low, but it's not, and you wake up on the floor naked at a house you don't know, in a place in another city, and you don't have no recollection of what has happened or what has occurred. And it's like, again, Monica, like, what are you doing, you know? So I remember, I think I may have had, I attempted to kill myself, but it wasn't like a serious attempt. But I remember it wasn't enough to make me stop drinking. So at this point, I believe I had already lost my job. I got kicked out of Fresno State. And I was just, you know, I was introduced to drinking every day. I was, started out as binge drinking Friday through Sunday, and then it turned into every day. And I, you know, I think I had, for whatever reason, gotten a little bit of sobriety together and got back into Fresno State. So I was like, okay, you know, I can get this together, you know. But of course, you know, I didn't know it at the time, you know, that I'm an alcoholic. So I started drinking again. I get kicked out of Fresno State again because I can't stop drinking. So by this time, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, have nothing. Like, a lot of people talk about how they lost their wives and their kids or whatever. Like, I lost my self-respect and my dignity. I have lost my friends. You know, I'm that person who wakes up and doesn't know where their car is, doesn't know if I drunk drove, doesn't know who I pissed off. I usually wake up in the morning with, like, people mad at me. I like to start fights, but I don't get into them. So a lot of my times, you know, I'm a blackout drinker, so a lot of times I come to, there's, you know, two guys getting each other's face, telling each other off, and I'm just like, no idea what I did to start that. But anyway, sorry. So what brought me to these rooms is I was sought outside help because I had a mental breakdown. And, you know, of course, you know, you're doing drugs and alcohol and you're extremely depressed. And it's like, I was literally like, I'm going to kill myself. Somebody needs to help me. And I threw a fit at the mental health clinic, and I, like, told them they needed to help me. I wasn't going to hurt myself. And so they agreed to start seeing me, and it was there that I was, they were like, how much are you drinking? And I was like a six pack, not a big deal. You know, that was a lie, but they would always bring up my drinking, and I would be like, well, why is that, like, important? You know, I didn't come here to talk about how much I drank. I come here to talk about how you guys are the problem, how people don't love me, how people treat me wrong, you know, when I'm doing all these, like, jacked up stuff when I'm drinking. So, I keep attending those, you know, going to therapy, seeing the psychiatrist, and I finally was given my first big book. And I thought, okay, like, maybe I should consider this, you know, I'm pretty desperate right now. And she gave me the number of somebody who took me to my first meeting, and you know, for that, I'm extremely grateful for the 12 step. And that there are people who answer their phone when you call. These people who have no reason to care for you, to, you know, they have no idea who you are, but they, like, pick up the phone. And I remember my therapist saying, you need to call today before you change your mind. So I did. No, I didn't. I waited till the next day. And then I was like, it was Tuesday and the meeting was going to be Wednesday. So I called her and she said she couldn't be there, but she had somebody meet me. And I remember being in my first meeting and it felt like surreal. I felt like I wasn't in that chair and I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience. Like, I guess I sort of dissociated. But I remember listening to the things that you guys said, and, you know, and for that I do stress that you guys listen to the similarities and not the differences in my story so that you guys can relate. But I remember listening to the way you guys felt. I remember you guys, you know, talking about the incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I remember you guys talking about the desperation and the pain. And that was what was, you know, what struck a chord with me. And I've heard it said before, but I remember you guys laughing and thinking you guys are crazy. And don't you know how much pain I'm in? And you guys are laughing? Like, how dare you? And, you know, now it feels good to be able to be those people laughing and being crazy with everyone else here. And so I kept coming back and I kept sticking with the winners. You know, it was a bunch of old timers. I'm from Porterville. So I kept hanging out with them. They would pick me up and take me to meetings. They would invite me everywhere with them. And even when I didn't want to go, there was not an excuse. It was like, we're picking you up at 8. And I'm like, 8 in the morning? Who wakes up at that time? You know, not me. And so, you know, we would go out to the speaker breakfast in Springville. And they introduced me to all their friends. And, you know, I wish I could tell you guys that it worked that time, but it didn't. But I can tell you why it didn't work. It didn't work because I was not honest, open, or willing to work my program. I lied, which is why I told you guys that I wanted to be as honest as possible with you guys today. I'm a really big liar, and that's one of my biggest character defects that was discovered in my sixth step. And I forgot where I was going with this. Why it didn't work. And then I could be open, but I couldn't be honest at the same time, or if I had the willingness, like, I would lie. So it's like really key to have those three things at the same time. And I wasn't, and you know, the book talks about the half measures availed us nothing. I had one foot in the door, one foot out the door. I was not 100% convinced that I was an alcoholic. I thought, I'm too young to be here. I still have so much drinking left in me to do. So much more incomprehensible demoralization to do. And I knew, like, a part of me had the doubt, what did she read, you know, go to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking? Like, I literally thought I could control it. I literally thought that I needed to get out there and test it, because that little bit of doubt was what got me to drink again. And I could tell you about that first drink. That first drink, when I went back out, was when I admitted that I was an alcoholic. I admitted utter defeat. I admitted that my life was unmanageable and like that I couldn't do it. It was an immediate obsession, immediate physical craving, that first drink that I took when I went back out. It was like, oh, you know, I was going to say that word, but really, there's a lot of children here, and it's being recorded also. I was like, oh, damn, I'm an alcoholic. And it was on. It wasn't like, you know, the book also talks about that this disease is progressive. I started out having these fun, lavish, you know, parties, drinking, fancy, cool, exciting, you know, and it, you know, progresses into just being depressing, throwing up on yourself, waking up in random places, and then you end up where, you know, I was locked in my bedroom by myself, drinking every day. And I heard a speaker this weekend, that Akipaw, talk about, like, his drinking, and it was the same way that I drank. I woke up in the morning, and if I had 2 beers in the fridge, I couldn't drink. There needed to be enough in there. And I obsessed about it all day. I had to go to the store, and I had to make sure that I had enough to drink. I had to back up bottles hidden throughout my house in case I ran out, because that would be the worst case scenario right there. If I ran out, oh my God, that's the same feeling of, have you ever been like the DD and you can't drink? Awful feeling. You know, have you, like, the controlled drinking, you know, controlled drinking is not fun for me, because I'm an alcoholic. So I had to make sure that I had enough for the day, and like, the obsession was real. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that leads me to another reason why I didn't stay sober that first time. I opened my big book, and I was an extreme atheist, and I seen the word God, and I was like, F this, like, why am I going to read this? Like, I thought you guys were going to help me, and now the word God is here? Like, no, I can't do this. I'm not going to take this stuff seriously. So, that kind of, like, weaves into my half measures, you know, was like, oh, sure, you know, I'll do second step, you know, I don't know what higher power is, but I don't really believe in that bull. And, you know, this time in my sobriety, my recovery, I do have a higher power, and it's a higher power of my understanding, and it's not yours, and it's mine, and it is a whole entity encompassing everybody, and I get to pick exactly what it is. You know, he's loving, he's compassionate, he's kind, he's understanding, and that's my higher power for me today. And I do like to say, though, if you're working on your second step, you don't need to know exactly what that is, you just have to be willing. And so I remember going to this retreat with these women to Malibu, and where we were at was like kind of like on a cliff looking out onto Malibu, and there's like a friar on standing out there, and it's all lit up pretty, and I just kept thinking about how I did not want to be there, how I would rather be anywhere but there. I would rather be, you know, who could I be partying with? How much could I be drinking alone in my room right now? And I was there, and it was like, you know, up until that point, I think I had 6 months of sobriety, and And I was invited on this trip, and I didn't want to go. And the reason why I didn't want to go was because I had 3 months sobriety when I was asked, and it was 3 months later, and I would have to stay sober for 3 more months. And I was like, no. But somebody, you know, an old-timer in Porterville actually agreed to sponsor me on that trip, and she agreed to pay for it, which I really am extremely grateful for it, because I really feel that it was something that jump-started my sobriety once I went on that trip with those women. So if you guys ever come across any, like, men's retreats or women's retreats, I strongly recommend that you go to them. So I was standing there in Malibu, and I couldn't, you know, wait to leave there. So, and I was, you know, the obsession was still there. The obsession hadn't been lifted, but I had not given any time to actually ask God to remove it. I had never prayed at all, because that was something that was just foreign to me. It was a complete foreign concept, prayer. And I remember asking God to remove the obsession, and He did. And I thought at that moment, I'm willing to go to any length to work this program if that's what God could do for me. And I hope that you guys, you know, are at that point where you're willing to go to any length, because I have 2 years of sobriety. And I never thought that I would be up here in front of you guys. I am extremely grateful, extremely proud of myself. I never thought anyone would even want me up here. But today, you know, I get to forgive myself for the things that I've done. I get to ask other people to forgive me for the crap that I put them through. And, you know, I'm not perfect. You know, I have my list of character defects, but I work on them. I'm aware of them, and I get to, like, do something about it. This is a program of action, and I think that we are the bravest people that exist, like some of the bravest people that get to come here, get to come to these rooms, get to talk about our crap. Yay, the napkin guy. And we get to bare our souls. And like this, for me, coming up here is a huge feat for me, because I, you know, due to my background, I, you know, the kind of family I came from, and I come from an alcoholic background, you know, it was strongly discouraged to talk about feelings. It was, you know, you don't, keep your head down, Monica, shut up, stop talking, don't do that, you're doing this wrong. Like, that's what I heard my entire childhood from my entire family. So to come in here, or to come into any meeting and be able to share, was extremely hard for me. I remember, I think I did not share for the first 6 months that I came to this program, because I was literally not capable of it. So, I would like to talk to you about miracles. I recently finished my bachelor's degree. So, I got kicked out of Fresno State twice. But because I got sober, I could go back to school, and I was able to, like, believe in myself. And, like, I'm not very close to my family, so you guys have become my family, and you guys, you know, help me, like, walk through that, and help me, you know, keep my head straight and still work my program and still be able to, like, go to school. And then, you know, I don't recommend this next thing. Through my sixth step, you know, I was able to see my character defects, but I was able to see, I was, what does the book say? That we were held on to, like, old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go of them absolutely. Well, I couldn't do that. I couldn't let them go. So I don't recommend it. So when it says to let them go and to pray for God to remove your shortcomings, I strongly recommend that they do, because I had an unfortunate incident where I was not willing to let go of old behavior, and I had a terrible incident happen to me, which I will just talk about in general. But I feel like God had that happen to me so I could let go of that behavior. It's like, how much pain do you have to be in, Monica? You know, I'm here to tell you that, like, this all happened because I was complacent in my program. I wasn't going to as many meetings. I was keeping secrets from my sponsor. And it's not a good idea, you know, to not go to as many meetings, you know, stop calling people, to stop being in touch with the program, because it led to chaos in my life. It was a terrible time of my life, and that chaos for me resembles me still drinking. That is me being a dry drunk. And I was not, you know, I wasn't drinking, but I was acting exactly like it. I wasn't being responsible. I was calling into work, missing class, lying, doing shady behavior, I'll just say that. And, you know, I honestly, I had to do a lot of step work, and the people and the women in these rooms helped me walk through that, and I felt like God did that to me so he could remove that character defect from my life. By the way, I'm a crier. Like, no kidding. Like, everybody here who's seen me at a meeting has seen me cry. I can feel my feelings today, and I don't have to take anything to, like, help me anesthetize. I don't know how to say that word. Anesthetize. So, another reason I forgot why I didn't stay sober the first time was, you know, that I couldn't completely do step one. And I think that's like your foundation right there. So I think if you're doing your steps, or you just started, or you're in your first 30 days, I think it's extremely important that you, you know, admit to yourself, like, admit completely, like, learn exactly what alcoholism is, learn about the obsession, learn about the physical craving, and know exactly that you're an alcoholic, because I feel like if you don't do that, you are not going to stay sober. And I think that's why it says, you know, step out to the nearest bar room. You know, it's not really meant to say, hey, relapse again, but, you know, if you can't do that, you can't stay sober, you know, if you don't know that. And for me, I couldn't see my life as being unmanageable when I first got here. I honestly thought that I lived a normal life, that everybody drank like me. But I found out later that I only surrounded myself with people who could drink like me. I only surrounded myself with people who left a 12-pack in their car and then went up to the party and drank all their beer just to have my 12-pack when I got down, if I could find my car. And then I sat in these rooms and I listened to you guys, and I was like, hey, I used to drink in high school. I'm like, hey, I got drunk with my family. You know, hey, you woke up in another city too. You know, then it's like, then I started to see, like, oh no, I have a lot in common with these people who call themselves alcoholics. You know, I might be an alcoholic. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit scattered. But I have like a few minutes left. I actually don't have sponsor anybody right now, but I am willing and ready to do so. I do recommend, you know, my sponsor, who's here with me today. Just celebrated 7 years, and she's also a young person. As Bill Hatzman talked about me being a part of the young people community, if you're a young person, or not a young person, I highly recommend that you find that little group of people who have what you want and who work their program like you want to work your program so that you can continue to do so. Because I feel like all the people that I hang out with, they do their step work, they meet with their sponsors, they go to meetings. Like, I don't hang out with anybody who really doesn't, like, do so. Like, that's just become my life. Like, I know that I will have to do this for the rest of my life, but I don't have to do it alone, and I only have to do it one day at a time. Like, I would love to have 7 years or 20 years, but today, like, I only have today. I don't know if I'm going to be sober. I don't know if something's going to happen tomorrow or whatever. Like, but I don't need to know right now. Excuse me. Oh, and about that fourth step. The first time, I think I sat on it for like 6 months. I don't recommend you do that either. But I think for me, what was extremely helpful working my steps this time was that I felt that my sponsor had my story. She had what I wanted. I related to her. And I felt like she cared about me. And she didn't know me. I remember like the second time or third time we hung out, she told me she loved me. And I was like, oh, that's crazy. You didn't even know me. But now I know what that feels like. Now I know what that feels like when you guys came up here and you're new. And like why the program is here and why we say that we're here to love you when you can't love yourself. You know, I've had to borrow that love from this program. I've had to borrow the courage from this program. And I am just extremely grateful to be here. I don't know what else to say right now. But thank you for having me. My name is Monica, and I'm an alcoholic.
I finished a little bit early.
You're fine. You did a great job. Thank you, Monica.